Hi folks, welcome to part two of the weekend podcast that myself and Hugo are recording about, again, The Great Reset. On the previous one that presumably you watched, we talked about the increased role of government that Schwab wants in the economy, and now we're going to talk about the individual reset. So how the individual is presumably going to respond to this massive increase in government intervention in the economy. So Hugo, how screwed are we?
So the individual reset is part of Klaus Schwab's book. He says there is a macro reset, micro reset, and individual reset. Right? And so we're going to be talking about the individual reset. And it's interesting how it relates to the other parts of his book, because the book is kind of a mix of things that he says are happening and that he says should happen. And it's often not really clear in the way that he speaks about it, which thing it actually is, if it's a form or the latter. He makes it really mixed, and it makes you really confused at times when you're reading it, because you're not actually sure whether he's just saying someone else says it or whether he's just saying it himself. Like, not explicitly, obviously, he says when he's quoting someone, but at the same time he says, okay, so this is a problem, this is a case, and this is being dealt with in this way, and he's always saying it in an approving manner.
Yeah.
And so It's a really weird framing, and it's actually written very suggestively in that way. Mm-hmm. So he's presenting his opinions and his what he would like to see and what he would like to do as something that is already happening, and that is already like one solution that is already being practiced to some problems that we have around us now. And so this part of the individual reset is more of saying what is going to happen, what is happening in response to all the changes that we have had over this year, mm-hmm. in response to the pandemic and the lockdowns and everything. And so he says that how we relate to other people and to our world will change because of the pandemic and because of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so he's got three main sections of this, subsections of this section, redefining our humanness, mental health and well-being, and changing priorities.
Redefining our humanness.
Yeah.
For anyone, like, this is one of the most ancient of philosophical questions. What does it mean to be human? What is a good human life? What does it involve? And I don't want to talk Klaus Schwab down, but I just don't think he's the guy to answer this. It's been going on for thousands of years.
I don't think that's exactly what he means, because he doesn't mean how should we redefine our humanness, but how is our humanness being redefined faced with these challenges of this year?
How is it being done for us? Right. Okay.
Yeah. And so he says that during the first months of the pandemic, when people were helping each other out, and you can see like these all random kinds of acts of kindness, in terms of what we valued, the notions of cooperation, communitarian ideas, the sacrifice of self-interest for the common good, and caring came to the fore. So
did it?
I don't know. He says that he was happy to see all the people helping each other out and like caring for one another in these strange and unprecedented times.
But this just sounds like, honestly, kind of like communist wish fulfillment. This is something you can go through honestly, going back to the French Revolution, but any of the sort of like radical left-wing manifestos and like propositions for an ideal future.
Yeah.
And it always revolves around this kind of communitarian, everyone is dependent on everyone else, and therefore no one should own anything because it should be owned by everyone. And I mean, to every single one, like Marx, Kropotkin, all of them, you know, all have this view that there's the masses helping, you know, helping one another out, living in like big houses and sharing kitchens and stuff like this. Like, but what are you talking about? Like, everyone just stayed at home.
Yeah. Machiavelli, like, the Commonwealth should be rich, but the people should be poor.
yes, actually, that's exactly what they're saying.
And so he's seeing all these random kinds of acts of kindness around him, and he likes it. But he misinterprets it as showing like communitarian ideals that people would have, rather than just like helping each other out, but like just still because they like each other and just want to help.
Friends, right?
So it's not something like something
new or
and
unique.
It's not something ideological, right?
No.
And so he asks whether we will become more caring and compassionate.
okay.
He asked that because he says that during pandemics, people tend to the pandemics tend to drive people apart because people are uncertain. They're isolated. They don't know who might be infected, who might be a threat. That's in contrast with other natural disasters which happen quick and in which the response is overwhelmingly like caring and
people kind of do helping. Actually pull together in the face of like, you know, the typhoons because and
the bad tsunamis. Thing had already happened, so you don't need to be afraid anymore, you can just like solve it, right? And so pandemics are different in that ways, and so he says, will we become more caring and compassionate if pandemics usually go that way? And so then he kind of turns a little bit. He quotes Orhan Pamuk, which is a novelist, who says, Orhan Pamuk recounts how people have always responded to epidemics by spreading rumors and false information and portraying the disease as foreign and brought in with malicious intent. Portraying the disease as foreign.
I mean, it is.
It is.
It's just... I mean, I guess they can't do that in China, so I guess Chinese government must feel personally attacked.
Orhan Pamuk is Turkish. He's not Chinese. Like, it's still foreign to him. And it's this whole individual reset part is really annoying to read in some way, because he uses the word "we" all the time, and he
for the individual reset.
He attempts to construct this kind of communitarian narrative that we are all in this together, and we all need to like pull on the same side of the rope, end of the rope. And so I'm just reading some of these passages and just unreal. Just I'll read one and just notice the "we" and this kind of framing. Yeah. So quote: "Will COVID-19 result in people withdrawing into themselves, or will it nourish their innate sense of empathy and collaboration, encouraging them towards greater solidarity? The examples of previous pandemics are not very encouraging, but this time there is a fundamental difference. We are all collectively aware that without greater collaboration, we will be unable to address the global challenges we collectively face. Put in the simplest possible terms, if, as human beings, we do not collaborate to confront our existential challenges, the environment and the global governance freefall, among others, we are doomed."
I hate everything about that framing.
Exactly. And so what I was kind of thinking when I read it is, like, we're not filming this live, so this people could rewind. And so when people watch it, they should try to, like, in their minds, replace "we" with something like Davos, or like "we" as in Klaus Schwab's group, right?
Yeah.
And so do that, and then rewind and listen to me say it again, because I think it's very telling. If you think of it like that, it makes much more sense, because there are threats to Klaus Schwab's kind of idea of the world, and that they are real, and some of them are intensified by the pandemic and by what's going on. And so he is right in saying, okay, if we don't do something really fast and really intensely, we're not going to have as much power in the future, which is true. And so if you read it in that kind of sense, then it makes much more sense.
But the thing is, I mean, and that's good, because it doesn't make any sense prior. You know, we have to be collaborative. Yeah. Human beings have always been collaborative in literally everything they've ever done. Even you know, taking up a like arts and crafts project is collaborative, because you had to go to the shop to buy the equipment. And that, you know, the Milton Friedman's famous sort of pencil example. It's like where he goes through the economic life that is required to make a pencil. The graphite comes from here, the wood comes from here, it's all put together in a factory here, it's distributed around the world, and eventually you get like a very cheap pencil because of the way that the system works. And it's like, okay, you can't say that's not collaborative. Like, again, this is, like, he's not setting up anything new, anything unique. This is not something, you know, he's thought up, oh, humans need to be collaborative. Shut up, Klaus. That doesn't make any sense. You know, like, you're not dividing all of human history into the non-collaborative part, and then now the Klaus Schwab era is going to, finally, we agreed we were going to work together.
He's acting as if the whole world was just like islands of Robinson Crusoes, right?
Yeah, Hobbes's.
No, like sort of, islands of individual Robinson Crusoes that were just like doing crafts and stuff with like bare hands and a knife. And
Klaus Schwab came along and said, we should work together.
If it were like that, there would be no civilization. That's not like, this is just such a. The framing is so terrible. I can't even.
I agree. I completely agree.
So. He says, he ends the He talks then about the difference between utilitarian calculus and the sacrosanct principle of sanctity of life, and how these two go together. If people decide how to deal with the pandemic, or do lockdowns or not do lockdowns, things like that. Mm-hmm. This is a whole like Pandora's box that I don't want to open right now, because it's just
I'll go off on one about utilitarianism. So let's move.
We can have that for another segment.
I think we should, because there is a lot to say about utilitarianism.
And so in the redefining our humanness, how we ends that segment is, I'm calling everything a segment now, that subsection is saying, if in the future we abandon the posture of self-interest that pollutes so many of our social interaction, we may be able to pay more attention to issues like inclusivity and fairness.
I never thought about inclusivity and fairness before, Klaus. Exactly. We were constantly obsessed with being unfair, right? Until you mentioned it.
Constantly polluted with our self-interest.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But imagine viewing self-interest as a form of pollutant. How bizarre your worldview must be. Because obviously for normal people, self-interest is just their daily life. You can't help it. You're a biological organism with demands made upon you by the world. You've got to act in your self-interest to some degree.
You're oppressed by nature.
Yeah, you are being oppressed by nature. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so it's incredible that he sees it as something that pollutes, right?
That's amazing.
It's just not something that is conducive to social cooperation, and without, like, that there's just a response to biology, a response to just the world around us, and around which we can create our civilization that is nice and fair and inclusive, consequently, right?
Well, it seems like, you know, you go to a swamp and you pour some clean water into it, and you say, oh, my clean water's become polluted. It's like, well, I mean, it's a swamp. Like, this is just, you know, human beings are naturally like this, you know, all over the world. Why are you acting like this is the unusual part? So bizarre.
Well, the new socialist man isn't like that.
That's true. That is exactly true. And that's exactly what he's going
for. That's
a
historical thing. Look at that if you know. Yeah, if you don't know what we're talking about.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Right. And so then the other subsections of his individual reset are mental health and well-being and changing priorities. So with mental health, he's just quoting a lot of psychologists saying that the pandemic has had a devastating effect on mental health. Yeah. And he's completely right about that. Yeah. And he lists just like dozens of examples of effects of the pandemic and the lockdowns. He like doesn't make that distinction that much, but he does mention everything that's been negative about.
Yeah.
About,
and that's all broadly true.
Yeah, that's very true. And I don't really have much to say against what he's saying here, because he's just stating the facts. And if anything, he's understating it, which is horrible. But
forcing human beings into isolation is usually usually regarded as a cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah. And so the last part is changing priorities. And so he says that many people will ask themselves what is really important in their lives, amid all the changes that have happened. And if people, when people are forced to be alone and to kind of think about themselves and their own lives, and they're not really allowed to do anything else, they think about what's really important for them. So that might change some of their priorities even going forward, which is true. Like that's relevant. Like some people who have living very consumerist lifestyle, for example, might reconsider that and say, okay, like, is this really important for me, or have I just been doing that like
because it's
a treadmill, you know, it's just something that happens naturally. And so he also comes to that. He says that some forms of consumption will be maybe repressed or decided to be repressed because as a result of the pandemic. He says that these priorities might shift in a way to more care about each other and about the community and about the environment, right? And so therefore he says that it's going to translate into policy. And that's where it actually gets a bit, you know, weird, in the way that I was saying in the beginning, that you don't really know whether he's saying something is happening or something should happen. Because he says, okay, this is going to change in this way, but then he arrives at policies that he supports and he promotes the grid reset. And so this is all kind of
more government
very
intervention
suspicious
to prevent you from doing something that Klaus Schwab has decreed to be verboten.
Yeah. And so he says, I'm quote, a substantial number of columns and analyses state that in the post-pandemic era, we will become more conscious of the consequences of our choices and habits and will decide to repress some forms of consumption. And so I know that what he wants, but he presents his agenda as the choice of the people, like of everyone, which is going to be like
Klaus Schwab, voice of the people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then he goes on, the pandemic has acted as a dramatic eye-opener to the public at large on the severity of the risk related to environmental degradation and climate change.
What?
Just how? Why? Why?
Why did you
what?
Get that from?
That's just completely random. Like, if anything, people don't think about the climate at all because they have other things to care about.
Yeah. Just,
they have other problems exacerbated and caused by all this.
Far more direct problems.
Yeah. So this is just now. It is far much more removed than it was, for example, last year, right?
Yeah.
So last year you could say, okay, like we can, like it's an issue number one, like,
yeah.
Or it's need to raise awareness and things like that. It's in papers all the time. Okay, but that's not the case now.
But and
it has changed.
Even worse,
the opposite way.
Yeah. Even worse is that the argument for climate, you know, climate activism has actually been weakened by the pandemic because of the reduction in economic activity. Mm-hmm. So less has been produced, less has been moved, you know, I've seen articles talking about this. Oh, look, I mean, in Venice, for example, during the lockdown, the canals of Venice became clear, mm-hmm. and everyone could see the fish, yep. in the canals all of a sudden. They were, oh, isn't that nice and unique? It's like, yeah, you know, you're getting what you want, you know, yep. But anyway.
So I have no idea how he comes up with this phrase. It's just bizarre.
In, why not?
And so then he says he talks about social stuff. So he's saying extreme inequality erodes the social contract, and he says that conspicuous consumption must change. He doesn't say that verbatim, but he's very strong about it. This is a summary of it. And so conspicuous consumption, like he's saying, all these people that have these luxury things and new models of everything. Mm-hmm. This is not going to be the norm in the post COVID world because people are going to look down on it. It's going to be a source of shame, not a source of pride.
Oh.
And so he's saying like that. This is something that will happen because right now everyone's struggling. No one's got money. No one's got their jobs. So people will feel more resentment towards those who live in, like, lavish lifestyles. Okay, that's reasonable. But at the same time, he also markets this whole thing in this very weird way or suspicious way that is tied to his whole agenda. So it's just sad how he deals with some of the things that might be true on the one hand, but he misleads you with how he frames it on the other hand.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, if there's one way of avoiding conspicuous consumption, I would suggest it's giving people free money. That's certainly not going to make them buy things frivolously.
So he continues that, quote, this might be another personal reset. The understanding that conspicuous consumption or excessive consumption of any kind is neither good for us nor for the planet.
I mean, I do agree with him here. Like, I'm not much of a consumer myself, you know. Yeah. I don't buy a lot, to be honest.
Neither am I.
You know,
but like what he says, that this is going to be an understanding that is reached by society, and so the rules that society is governed by, like, that's his framing, not mine, are gonna reflect this, and so people will not do it anymore because they will be prohibited from doing so. That's what he's saying.
It's got to be government intervention, because if there's one thing that utilitarianism, and all the way going back to, like, Epicureanism, has shown us, is that the utilitarian/Epicurean argument that people actually won't become hedonistic animals who just live to consume, mm-hmm. and live to enjoy bodily pleasure is wrong. They will.
Yeah. And so he's saying it's neither good for us nor for our planet. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe it's not good for him. Maybe it's not good for me. For you,
I actually do agree with.
Yeah,
that,
but okay, maybe
the government shouldn't have an action.
Maybe it's not good for him or me or you, but it might be good for someone. I don't know that better than they do. Right?
Yep.
So, I wouldn't be making that statement for everyone.
Especially if I'd not just come out of a segment where I'm saying, well, by the way, we're going to have government controlling almost every aspect of your life,
yeah.
And also you need to stop consuming this. You need to stop doing that. It's like, I mean, you know, like you say, on a personal level, I do agree with him. You know, that we, you know, don't be just a coomer. Don't spend all your money on sugar and caffeine and alcohol and all this sort of stuff. You know, don't buy just random junk from China. You know, I agree with these things, but I don't want the government telling me I can't do these things. You know,
exactly. It's saying, well, you're saying that people shouldn't do it, not that people shouldn't be allowed to do it. But if, like, it's a personal choice, if it's not a personal choice, then it has no value.
Yeah, exactly. And not just that, there could be a time where that is a necessary thing to do. You know, you might need to do something like that. And I don't know. I'm not going to judge. You know, if I'm in that situation, then I'd doubtless view the thing, you know, the situation the same. But like you say, I just don't think the government should be able to tell you you shouldn't be able to, or you can't do that. You know, it's your decision to make for yourself. And the thing is, if it's not your decision to make, then you're not going to... The point of, like, understanding and making these decisions is you growing as a person, you becoming a more mature person and becoming more responsible with yourself and the environment around you. If you take that away from people, then you're going to just infantilize them and create a generation of isolated, atomized coomers who just have nothing else to do but just follow orders.
But that's why I'm saying it has to be a personal decision, because when it's not, it doesn't affect you, it's forced upon you, and it doesn't change you, right? You need, like, if you want to change yourself by not, like, being in that way in, like, some kind of a sorry state of existence in one way or the other, like, you need to make the change happen. You can't be forced into it. That's not how it works.
If you don't choose it for yourself, then it's worthless.
And so so that's been basically everything. So I just, like, wrap it up. And just by saying that this whole thing is very weird, as I said in the beginning, in the way that you never know when Schwab is actually talking about what is going on, what is happening, and just documenting things, and when he's advocating for things. And so he's not saying just what happens, but he's also personally in a position to pave the way for something to happen if he wants to. He's not just an observer, he's just not describing what's going on around you, he's also, like, building your future.
So it's very much a plan for the future, for your future, you know, that he's not going to be subject to.
And so even if he's just saying, like, okay, this is happening, this was a response to this, he's saying in it in an improving manner. Another thing is he's in a position to promote the solutions that he'd like to see and push away those that he wouldn't. So, like, this is just it's way more suspicious when he talks about, when he's just describing something, just because of who he is.
Okay.